Welcome to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. I'm here with engineer Mike Murphy, and Anna Banana will be joining us later on in the show. Today is Washington's birthday. Happy birthday, George. And it is partly sunny and cold, and it's going to be cold as heck all week. Today, it is expected to get up to all of negative 3 degrees. That's the best it can do. And get this, with wind chill, it may get down to negative 35. Tonight, temperatures are expected around negative 20, and then there is the wind chill. Tuesday will be sunny, but with a high of 1 degree. And again, the wind chill bringing it down to negative 35. Tuesday night, negative 8. Wednesday, we'll see a chance of more snow, but it should at least get a little bit up into the teens again. Thursday should get all the way up to 14 degrees during the day, and Friday may see 18 degrees. By Saturday, it is predicted to get up to 28 degrees, and by Sunday, it will almost feel tropical in the low 30s. So be careful this week. It looks like there is light at the end of the tunnel, but it's going to be one cold tunnel before we get there. And so here is Dennis Hart with news from Iowa.
Cold weather, terribly cold weather, dominated the news around Iowa last week, right up to this moment. How cold was it? So cold that the Des Moines Register reported that on Friday, it was colder in Des Moines than it was in Anchorage, Alaska. Colder than it was in Moscow. Colder than it was in Oslo, Norway. Colder than, well, you get the idea. I hope you're staying warm. Another big story across Iowa and around the nation, the vote in the U.S. Senate on Saturday. A majority of senators voted that former President Donald Trump was guilty of inciting last month's violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, but the Constitution requires a two-thirds vote to convict, so the former president was not convicted. Iowa's two Republican U.S. senators voted against convicting Trump. Meanwhile, the coronavirus continued making big news around the state. The death toll from the virus kept going up, exceeding 5,200 by yesterday afternoon. And the number of people infected by the virus also kept rising, reaching more than 329,000 by yesterday. Both numbers were going up slower than they had been. But health officials confirmed that 5 more cases of a virus variant discovered in the United Kingdom had been confirmed in Iowa. Experts warned it might be deadlier than the original coronavirus. The Des Moines Register reported that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds had not consulted with state health officials about her decision to drop coronavirus mask rules a week ago. Last Wednesday, the governor defended her decision, saying Iowans do not need government to tell them how to protect themselves from the virus. In her words, Iowans know what to do. We've been telling them for a year what they need to do, and they're doing it. Unlike many other governors, Reynolds did not put a mask mandate into place until last November, when coronavirus infections and hospitalizations surged around the state. In Metro Des Moines, there was no big rush among businesses to drop their mask requirements, even though the governor had dropped the state's requirements. Numerous bars and restaurants there posted social media messages that they would be keeping their requirements. Also last week, new information from the Federal Centers for Disease Control showed that Iowa ranks near the bottom among all 50 states in its ability to administer coronavirus shots. Fewer than 8% of state residents had received at least one vaccine dose. Alaska leads the nation, with 15% of that state's residents having received at least one dose. At the same time last week, there was word that Iowans could start receiving a quicker rollout of vaccine. Hy-Vee is taking part in the Federal Retail Pharmacy Program, which will send vaccines straight from the CDC to pharmacies. And there was word that the state health department would start requiring counties to use 80% of the vaccine doses they had received in the prior week, before they become eligible to get their next weekly allotment of vaccines. The state said it would withhold vaccine shipments to 5 counties that did not meet the 80% standard. State health officials did not identify those counties. There was also word that of those who had received the vaccine, people of color were being vaccinated at lower rates than white people. White Iowans had received more than double the doses of vaccine per 1,000 population than black Iowans. Meanwhile, the Des Moines Public School District said it would add instructional time to students' days in an effort to meet state requirements. Back in September, the district began the school year online because of the coronavirus pandemic. The Iowa Department of Education determined the district was not in compliance with state requirements. So the district has to make up more than 93 hours of lost instruction time for elementary students, 110 hours for middle school students, and about 140 hours for high school students. All this as the Federal Centers for Disease Control released new guidelines this past Friday on reopening schools across the nation. The CDC said schools can reopen safely during the coronavirus pandemic if safety measures are taken, such as the use of face masks and keeping 6 feet of social distancing inside school buildings. The CDC said vaccinating teachers is not a must for in-person instruction. Two more notes from the pandemic front. First, there was word last week that barring a resurgence of the virus this coming summer, the Iowa State Fair will take place. As we all remember, it was canceled last summer. But the Des Moines-St. Patrick's Day Parade will be canceled again this year because of the virus. In other news last week, word that after an almost two-month wait, several thousand Iowans who are entitled to benefits under a pair of federal programs for people who are not eligible for state jobless compensation should begin receiving their benefits soon. The program gives compensation to people who did not qualify for standard unemployment, such as self-employed workers and independent contractors. On the state legislative front last week, a resolution that would give Iowa voters a chance to amend the state constitution to say there is no fundamental right to abortion or public funding for it passed a committee in the state Senate. The entire Senate passed a similar resolution last year, but at that time, the state House of Representatives did not support it. Last month, the House of Representatives did pass a similar resolution. Also last week, the State House Education Committee passed a measure that would ban tenure at Iowa State University, the University of Iowa, and the University of Northern Iowa. A Senate Education Committee advanced a similar measure. Lawmakers have introduced bills to ban tenure at public universities in Iowa over the past several years, and those bills have always died. But this year may be different, because of concerns that conservative students think their viewpoints are unwelcome on campuses. Also last week, both state houses passed school funding proposals that would increase supplemental state aid for the upcoming school year. In addition to that increase, the bill would provide additional funding for transportation equity between districts and for schools that comply with state coronavirus reopening guidelines. And the Iowa House passed 6 child care bills last week, most of them passing on a bipartisan basis with near unanimous consent. Those bills expand tax credits for parents and for employers who provide child care, and increase reimbursements for child care providers. Also last week, a bill that would require transgender people in Iowa schools to use bathrooms that correspond to the sex listed on their birth certificates won a subcommittee vote in the Iowa Senate. The measure would apply to people using bathrooms in elementary and secondary public and non-public schools. Other so-called bathroom bills have been introduced in Iowa over the past several years, but none had ever received even a subcommittee hearing until last week. There was also word that a measure to ban public schools from using a project that teaches about slavery won approval in a House subcommittee, making it eligible for consideration by the state's House Education Committee. The bill would ban schools, colleges, and state public universities from incorporating the New York Times 1619 Project in U.S. history classes and would take away state aid from institutions that use it. The 1619 Project aims to reframe the way slavery and the contributions of black Americans are presented. Those who oppose it say it seeks to tear down America. And last week, bills were introduced in both the State House and the Senate that would stop construction of new confined animal feeding operations in Iowa. Supporters said the large-scale livestock raising facilities pollute Iowa's water and air and harm rural communities. It's the 4th straight year that such moratoriums have been proposed, and each time, Republicans in the legislature have killed them. And an Iowa lawmaker proposed legislation to waive millions of dollars in unemployment debts for workers who were laid off during the pandemic. The bill from Democratic House member Mary Wolf of Clinton would require Iowa Workforce Development to forgive debts owed by several thousand unemployment claimants. It comes 2 months after an investigation by the Des Moines Register found that many workers received bills to repay Workforce Development for unemployment compensation received during the early weeks of the coronavirus pandemic. In other news last week, one man died and 24 other people were evacuated in an apartment fire in downtown Boone. When firefighters arrived at 814 8th Street, flames were coming from a fifth-floor apartment on the south side of the six-story building. Firefighters found the body of 66-year-old Michael Kreis. Some of the 24 residents were moved to a motel with help from the Salvation Army. There was also word last week that the state of Iowa had reached a $350,000 settlement agreement with a University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics patient who had sued 2 years ago after hip surgery left her with a nerve dysfunction that caused weakness, numbness, and tingling pain. The money will be paid to Aaron Jacobson of Linn County, pending approval from the state appeal board. There was also a report last week that a Simpson College administrator had received racist and anti-Semitic text messages. Assistant Director of Admissions Emily Radke had reportedly received two such messages containing hateful language from an unknown source through one of the college's communication channels. College officials were investigating. Also last week, word that Allegiant Air planned to add nonstop flights from the Des Moines Airport to Portland, Oregon, San Diego, and Houston. The seasonal flights will start July 1st and be offered twice daily on Sundays and Thursdays. With those flight additions, Allegiant will offer 13 nonstop destinations from Des Moines, including 5 to Florida and flights to Nashville, Phoenix, Austin, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas. And one more note before I go, word that Iowa State University football coach Matt Campbell had agreed to a new contract with the university, one that will keep him as coach through the year 2028. Campbell led the Cyclones to their most successful football season in history last year with a Big 12 game appearance and a Fiesta Bowl championship. Terms of the new deal were not announced, but Campbell earned an average of $3.5 million a year during his previous contract, which ran through 2025. And that is your summary of the week's news from all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, leaving now, but already making plans to come back to this same virtual seat on Friday, when I'll report on what makes news in Ames.
Welcome back to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. And February has significance for Access, which is the Assault Care Center extending shelter here in central Iowa. It's a regional nonprofit organization that helps survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and other types of violence. And the organization started out as one telephone line here in Ames, and has grown into an organization that serves several counties in central Iowa. This month, Access is celebrating its 45th anniversary, and we congratulate you on that. And to celebrate this, Access is commemorating historical landmarks and people who made this organization possible with an oral history project called Accessing Our History. KHOI and Access staff have been recording oral histories from people involved with the organization throughout the years, and we're pleased to share some of this, what was gathered in a three-part series here on Local Talk, this being the third of the series. And last, the two Mondays on Local Talk, Tess Cody, Executive Director of Access, and Courtney Palmersheim, Development Coordinator and Producer for the Accessing Our History Project, introduced some of the aspects of the history of the organization, as well as some of the essence and meaning of the work at Access. They spoke a little bit about the founding of Access and that it was difficult initially to speak up about the need for such an organization in our community and to face pressure that existed and to ignore sexual assault and other violence against women. Tess and Courtney also introduced the voices of some of Access's advocates, the workers who are at the center of how Access serves to support people who have been assaulted. And they explored what it meant to be an advocate and the things that many people have learned from such work. So welcome back, Courtney Palmersheim, Development Director, Coordinator and Producer of Accessing Our History Project. It's good to have you back for a third time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Briefly, before we get into Accessing Our History Project, once again, please just quickly describe what Access is, what you do for the sake of anybody who's listening who doesn't know yet who you are.
Yeah, Access provides free confidential services to victims of domestic and sexual violence, as well as homicide and violent crimes. Access can provide a wider range of services. Really what Access advocates do is listen to the person, inform them of all of their options, and just support them in the path that they choose to go down. For the sake of just naming a few things, Access has 24/7 support lines, can provide guidance through the court system, as well as other systems like the university and healthcare systems. And Access can help find stable housing. And Access advocates can also just simply listen to you and hear your story.
And Courtney, you're developing a page on the Access website for the project. Tell us where that website is.
Our website is assaultcarecenter.org. And yeah, everything Accessing Our History lives there in its own tab. We just wanted to make sure that everything Accessing Our History had a place to live publicly so that anyone can read and listen to the amazing stories that we've been collecting. To actually navigate to the Accessing Our History tab, you hit donate in the upper right-hand corner, and then you'll see the Accessing Our History tab. There lives all of the stories, upcoming events, and ways to be involved.
Okay, thank you. So let's get started. Before we get started, to you, the listener, please be advised that this conversation involves topics of sexual assault and domestic violence and can trigger emotional responses. So, Courtney, tell us about today's last local talk installment about Accessing Our History from the organization Access.
Yeah, so doing this project has taught us a lot about not only the history of Access, but also its meaning in the community. We learned from the people who recorded their oral histories of being involved with Access over the years. In this three-part series here on Local Talk, we're sharing some of the themes that we heard emerge. During our first show on Local Talk 2 weeks ago, we talked about advocacy as an incredible learning experience for those who do the work. During the second show last week, we talked a little bit about the founding of Access and how this highlighted bravery and leadership. And today we want to return to the topic of advocacy, but this time from the perspective of how advocates serve survivors and why the anti-violence movement is so important. We brought another guest with us this morning to explore these ideas. Sue Tufte is currently a domestic abuse advocate at Access. Thanks for joining us this morning, Sue.
Thank you for having me.
And so you're a staff currently at Access, correct?
Yes, I am.
Can you just tell us a little bit about what you do?
I am the rural domestic abuse advocate, and I am located in Marshalltown. I cover the Marshall and Tama County, but I also have some client load in Story County also.
Great. What role does an advocate fulfill?
I fulfill being an advocate as someone that I'm there to listen. I'm there to empower someone who's experiencing domestic abuse. I'm there to validate their feelings and, like you said before, explore all the options that are available to them that they don't realize that are out there.
Definitely. When you think about like your daily tasks, what tasks does an advocate do?
Part of my daily tasks are, speaking to clients on the crisis line. Also, I do appointments over the phone right now due to us being home during this pandemic and working from there. I advise them on what their options are as far as like law enforcement reporting, court options, if they're looking into getting a restraining order, how to go about that and walking them through that. Also letting them know that there's safe shelter, but just being that ear for them to, you know, talk about what's going on and try to make them comfortable during this time.
Yeah. So it sounds a little complicated and sometimes tough. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to get involved?
Yes. Sometimes it is very tough. I've been doing this work for 23 years. I started out with another agency, out of Marshalltown, DVA SAC. And then when we had the funding changeover and regional change, that's when I came to Access in July of 2013. So I've seen a lot of changes, happen, and most of them are for the better. I remember when there were arrests happening, and now we have primary aggressor. We also have better ways of interviewing during an arrest when there is a domestic. Lots of more training for law enforcement, which is wonderful, and we have a good collaboration with them. You also see now where there's a no contact order that is at the, you know, the time of the arrest, where there never used to be. It was like they asked you, do you want one or don't you, and put you in a bad spot that way. So I've seen lots of changes throughout the years, and they've been good changes. And so I hope it continues to be that way.
Yeah. Do you think that this work has led you to develop an outlook on the anti-violence movement? And if so, what does the movement mean to you?
What it means to me is there is help out there. There is safety. I remember years ago, I'm also a survivor, and I remember how I felt at the time of, You carry a lot of shame with you and embarrassment, and you don't want to tell anybody. And knowing that there are agencies like Access out there that help you, they listen to you, they don't judge you, they're there to empower you. That's what got me involved in doing this kind of work, because I want everybody out there to know that you're not a lost cause. It's not your fault. And there is help, and there are people that care and will be there every step of the way with you.
Great. Thanks for sharing a little bit about yourself, Sue. We're excited to have you on with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah. We'd like to share with our listeners three audio clips from the oral histories that we've been collecting, and then have some discussion with you, Sue, as someone working at Access. The first clip is from Mary Howell Cerna, who has been involved with Access in multiple capacities since 1999. She's deeply committed to the work of the anti-violence movement. She's been a volunteer, a board member, and just a general supporter, and continues to show up for survivors. She understands why advocates are needed, which may not be as obvious if you have not been directly involved with a criminal case involving violence. It's hard to imagine what really happens. In this clip, Mary describes a little bit about one aspect of the process, the deposition, and why an advocate is needed for that.
The deposition process in the criminal process, it's an opportunity for a defense attorney to discover the state's case against their client. But what people don't realize is a lot of times that can be done in the jail, where the perpetrator is sitting across from a victim as their defense attorney is asking questions. It's very, very intimidating process. It's a process that society doesn't see, and it's all taken down by a court reporter, so you can't see the interaction between people. Jurors don't see, there's no judge there. And Access was an incredible buffer for us. process under the law is allowed to be there with the victim. So that was somebody in that victim's corner when we were going through these depositions, talking about the hardest thing that's probably ever happened to you in your life, and you had a lifesaver sitting there with you going through it. So when I think of access, I just think of them as a lifesaver. Access is there. If you have a problem at 2 o'clock in the morning, you can call the hotline. Access is going to be there at the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Okay, Sue, so that was Mary Howell Cerna. We just have a couple questions to ask you about her clip there. Why is it important for survivors to have an unbiased, always available support system?
It's important because we have friends and we have family that are good support systems, of course, but there's the bias there, and there's the ones that are telling you, you need to leave right now, you need to do this. Whereas access and advocates, we don't tell you what to do. We offer you options. Granted, we might think, you know, this is what you need to do, but we don't put that upon anybody. It's their life, it's their choice, and they need to know that we're validating their feelings, we're listening to them, and that we're there for them, regardless of whether they're doing maybe what's not the safest thing, but yet they know we're there and we're not biased on what they're making for their decisions.
Definitely. I imagine that it can be difficult to be that for survivors. How do you stay healthy and ready to support your clients?
Well, throughout the years, I've learned that, how to do that. I mean, it was very hard in the beginning. I had to choke back a lot of times. But I know that I myself, being a survivor, that I didn't want anybody to tell me what to do or how to do it. I just wanted somebody there to listen and to guide me. And so I think it takes time to get there in your journey as an advocate.
So Mary describes access advocates as lifesavers. Do you agree with that?
I do. In fact, I've had, you know, like several people that I've worked with pretty much say in so many words that I was a lifesaver, that they didn't know if they were going to make it through this without my support and my help and our agency and what we offer. And I'm glad that I could be there for them and get them so that they can live a safe, healthy life, which all of us deserve.
So Mary describes how an advocate can be a lifesaver during the stress of a deposition where the survivor has to face their attacker across from a table. Can you describe some other scenarios you know of or have been a part of where the advocate can make all the difference in the world?
Yes, I have sat in on many a deposition, and it is a very tough and tense time because, like Mary said, you're right directly across from your abuser, and that's very threatening. A lot of times that's the first time that they've seen them since the incident happened. Also, anytime there's court hearings or law enforcement reports where an advocate can be with that victim, that's very, very helpful because they have us as a buffer. They have us to be there to not necessarily speak for them, but they know that we're on their side and that we're going to see that they get through this, being by their side.
The power of an advocate deeply affects a survivor of violence when in crisis or during the many ordeals that a person might face in the long run afterwards. But beyond the individual client, having an advocacy organization in the community is also good for society. Harold and Marilyn Anderson spoke about this in their oral histories. They are a married couple who have both dedicated their time, care, and energy to Access. Harold is actually Access's longest running volunteer. He volunteered for Access for nearly 20 years. Marilyn volunteered for a while in college. both have remained active supporters of ACCESS. Here they are, and where they speak about the importance of advocacy.
I think ACCESS made the community better. Even the people that, not only the clients, the people that work there, I think are better people for having done it. And a lot of volunteers have gone through ACCESS at some time or another, people that are now community leaders, some of them, and I think they're better for it.
It felt really good to be able to help people in those situations.
Because I believe everybody counts. It was like they didn't count. That was the feeling. They didn't count. And people need to count.
Harold says, I believe everybody counts the same. People need to count. So how do we make sure that everyone feels seen and heard?
First of all, I think that when they tell us their story, we need to listen and we need to believe. I think there's so many times that people, they don't want to believe this is happening. And so it's easier to act like, oh, I don't believe that. I think they're exaggerating. Oh, it isn't that bad. And if it is that bad, then why don't they just leave? I mean, we hear that so much. And I think it is so, so very important to make sure that they know we hear them, we believe them. And no matter what, we're going to be by their side to help them through this the best way that we know how.
Harold indicated that survivors of violent crimes can be discounted and not heard without advocacy. Do you see this happening? And if so, why does that happen?
I do. I think a lot of times we have people that we work with that maybe are in this relationship for many years. And I think when they're continually, calling like law enforcement for help. Sometimes, people are like, why do they keep calling for help? They don't want to do anything about it. They don't want to change. And people get to the point where it's like, oh, here we are again type of thing. What they don't understand is, this is a cycle, and we don't live in those four walls. We don't know what goes on. We don't know what has precipitated this last assault. And really, people don't understand that what we feel is the right thing or the safe thing to do is not. I mean, look at how many times we see in the news where people have left their abusive partner and they've done everything right. They've got the restraining order. They've left. They've moved. They whatever. And this abuser has found them and sometimes has actually killed them. So we have that where sometimes it's safer to be where they're at than in the unknown because they don't know what they're thinking. When the abuser loses control, that's when it's very volatile, and a lot of people don't understand that.
So Harold says, I believe everybody counts the same. People need to count. Do you have words to live by like Harold?
Yeah, in a way, I guess I do. I guess this takes me back to when I first started this kind of work. And I can remember I had started out working in a shelter, and there was a young girl that came in. And really, she was pretty much the first client that I'd ever worked with. And she came in. She had no family support. They had pretty much disowned her. She had no friends because, of course, her abuser didn't allow that, isolated her. He was abusive to her in all ways. This was her first time ever leaving him. And she came to our shelter. And I remember sitting and talking to her for hours. And she felt so much better. She felt safe. She was able to think clearly. And then like 6 hours into being at the shelter, she had went upstairs, used the community phone and called her abuser. And then came down to tell me, I'm going to be leaving. I'm meeting so-and-so at the gas station. He's coming to get me to take me home. And I can just remember sitting there thinking, oh, my God, this girl is going to die. I knew the severity of what he had done to her. And I was so scared for her, but yet I was there for whatever decision she made. And I felt like I'd failed her. And I can remember talking with a coworker and just saying, you know, what did I do wrong? Why did she leave? You know, what could I have done? And I remember my coworker saying, just know you have planted the seed. She knows now there is somewhere safe to go. There are people there to talk to. You know, there is somewhere that when she makes that decision to leave, that she can go there, she's going to get the help she needs. And so that's what I live by. It's just knowing, even though they might not get out of that situation right then and there, I know I've planted that seed.
That's great, Sue. Thanks for sharing.
Sure.
One of the realities of advocacy work is that there is not always the happy ending that we may hope for. We heard a lot about how people at Access who have experienced this and learned to accept it. However, there are also successes that show firsthand how Access services impact a survivor's life. This can be very rewarding. Here's an audio clip from Judy Conlin, who was a board member in 1986, back in the beginning stages of Access history. Judy had a client who came for help as a result was able to move from the experience of disempowerment to rediscovering her own power and to creating a better life for herself. Being able to help someone through this is also powerfully rewarding. One does not forget witnessing such a transformation. Here's Judy speaking about that.
I had the opportunity to go to her graduation when she graduated with her bachelor's, and then when she graduated with her master's, and then when she graduated with her PhD. I get emotional thinking about it. What was so wonderful is to watch a woman whose head was initially bowed to lift and smile and laugh.
Judy explains an amazing experience. Sue, as an advocate, what does it feel like to see a client reach their goals?
It's an amazing feeling. You know, sometimes I don't think I can even describe the enormity of what that feels like. And to some people, if they haven't experienced it, they don't quite get it. But seeing one of the past clients that I've worked with, and we've helped her get into housing, her and her children now live in a place where it's safe and they can live a good life. And she went on to be able to get a job, whereas before she could never work because he would sabotage every job that she ever had. And now she has a good job. She's able to support her and her children. And just seeing the smiles on their faces, and you can just see that the weight has just lifted off of them and they're living the good life that they should be able to live. It's amazing.
Can you talk a little bit about what types of struggles you have seen for clients to regain their sense of personal power after experiencing violence?
Yeah, you know, in an abusive relationship, their self-confidence, their self-worth is gone. I mean, when you're told day after day that you're not worth a crap and you're ugly and you're dumb and you're never going to make it and you're nothing without me, and then to have them turn around and see that they do have self-worth, you know, that's very powerful.
So not all situations have a happy ending. What keeps you motivated to stay in the work when the outcome isn't what you hoped for?
I guess it sort of goes back to that planted the seed. I guess I just have to keep telling myself that this isn't the end and that there is going to be something that's going to change up, hopefully, even if it's one minor thing. I mean, maybe they don't get out or maybe they're always in this relationship, but maybe she's now able to actually get out and work and have that interaction where she never had that before. So I guess I always look at even the little things that maybe have changed for them as an accomplishment, and that makes me stay in there, because I know that they can do this. It's just sometimes it takes a very long time.
Sue, what words of encouragement would you leave people with today, whether they're a survivor, a general supporter of Access, or a young professional wanting to become an advocate?
I think what I would say to them is believe, always make sure to validate and to be there for them with no judgment. We're not living their life, and don't put your ideas of or your judgments on them, and to, you know, just be that supportive person. I mean, we're not their friends, but we are their support system, and just be there for them.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Sue.
Well, thank you.
Sue is currently a domestic abuse advocate at Access. It's really nice to be able to combine voices from Access's past with yours as the current staff member at Access.
And thank you, Sue, and Courtney, for this presentation. It's the last in a series of Access's Accessing Our History Project, which is an oral and written history project documenting the history of the organization, which is 45 years old this month. And it's really been an exploration of the meaning of the organization, and it's really been a pleasure to take this time to explore that and kind of see the inside of the organization a little bit, and the thinking and the feeling and the commitment that goes behind it. Courtney, tell us again where one can find this project online. You are going to be posting a lot more of the audio that has been recorded, right? There's hours and hours of audio. We've just heard not even the tip of the iceberg, just a snowflake on the top of the iceberg.
Correct. Yeah. So you can first follow our Facebook page, which is at Assault Care Center, as we'll be sharing snippets and stories of our past and peeks into the future. For the next 45 days, we'll be doing that. And then this project also lives on our website, assaultcarecenter.org, and on our YouTube channel, Assault Care Center. On our YouTube channel, that's where the actual like audio lives. So if you went there, that's where you could really check out the audio clips and dive into that part of the project.
And are the audio clips there, are they the whole interviews of the people?
On YouTube, it's just shortened like 2 to 3 minute clips where you really get the meat of what that person felt was their biggest takeaway from their time at Access. Uh-huh. But we do have the longer, like hour long clips as well.
Uh-huh. Okay. And can they be heard somewhere?
Those we're working on uploading to our website. They're just pretty long, so it takes a little bit of time to upload them.
Yeah.
They'll be on our website soon.
Okay. And the website again?
Assaultcarecenter.org.
And to find the Accessing History Project?
In the upper right-hand corner, click Donate, and then you'll see the Accessing Our History tab. Click there, and you'll find everything.
Okay, and again, if somebody listening needs help from Access or knows somebody that needs help, tell us again where you can be reached.
Yep, so all of our 24/7 helplines are listed on our website, but I'll go ahead and list them here as well. Our sexual abuse 24/7 line is 515-292-5378. Our domestic abuse 24/7 line is 515-292-0519. And our housing 24/7 helpline is 515-292-0543. And again, all of those can be found on our website, assaultcarecenter.org.
Assaultcarecenter.org. And we'll also post those numbers on KHOI's homepage along with the audio from the show. Thank you again for coming, Courtney. It's been really a pleasure to do these shows with you, as well as to partner with you to actually record the history. It's been an amazing learning experience for me. And this has been the third of three presentations from Access, the Assault Care Center Extending Shelter and Support, in honor of their 45th birthday. Happy birthday. Thank you to the listener, you, for taking in this story, and we hope that you can really have gotten something from it as well. It's a really proud local success story where many, many community members have really shown commitment and tremendous strength turn around some of the most difficult experiences that people have in our community. So thank you again, Courtney. It's been great to work with you on this, and maybe we'll record some more history soon.
Hopefully. Thank you so much for having us. It's been awesome to partner with you as someone who's been pivotal in the creation of Access.
Thank you. It's been personally rewarding for sure. Take care. And thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Call my baby. Feel the calm. If I call my baby, hot spring water, oh yeah, boy, wouldn't help her none. I mean, wouldn't help her none. It wouldn't help her none. Oh, if time don't get no better, down south, people, where the weather suits my clothes. Where the weather suits my clothes.
And that is the Cold Weather Blues, and you're listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. The 2021 NAACP Annual Freedom Fund event will be held virtually on Thursday, February 18th, with entertainment by talented high school students during the social hour at 6:30 p.m., followed by the keynote speaker, Kemba Smith Pradia, I think that's pronounced Prada, telling her inspiring story. For reservations, go to NAACPAMESIOWA.com. That's NAACPAMESIOWA.com. And listen in to Local Talk on Wednesday to learn more about this. So again, that's on February 18th, the 2021 NAACP Annual Freedom Fund event at 6:30 p.m. to be, which can be joined virtually online at their website. Anna Banana has joined us. Anna, are you here?
I am. And
hi, Anna.
So I do have a heart-to-heart that's inspired by Dennis Hart's message this morning, in that it is very, very cold. So I found this poem by Paul Houston, and it's titled An Iowa Winter Poem. It's winter in Iowa, and the gentle breeze blows 70 miles an hour at 30 below. Oh, how I love Iowa when the snow is up to your butt. You take a breath of winter air, and your nose gets frozen shut. Yes, the winter here is wonderful, so I guess I will hang around. I could never leave Iowa because my butt is frozen to the ground.
Well, that's cheerful.
It's cheerful and so true. It is so cold out there. So
I guess misery loves company.
So my heart-to-heart message on that note is everybody stay warm and drink some hot cocoa to cheer yourselves up. Now, as yesterday was Valentine's Day and today is President's Day, I thought my next heart-to-heart message would be from the courtship of Harry and Bess Truman. So some of you might know that Harry S. Truman and Bess Wallace carried on a 9-year courtship almost entirely through letters and some supervised visits.
Wow.
Harry first met Bess when they attended Sunday school together in 1890. Harry was 6 years old and Bess was 5. Aww. So one of their heart-to-heart messages, isn't that sweet? So here are a couple of their letters as a heart-to-heart message. So this is one is from December 31st, 1910. Like in any relationship, life got in the way of Harry and Bess's courtship. And he writes, "Nothing would please me better than to come to see you during the holidays or any other time for the matter of that. But Papa broke his leg the other day and I am the chief nurse next to my mother, besides being farm boss now. So you see, I'll be somewhat closely confined for some time to come. I hope you'll let the invitation be a standing one, though, and I shall avail myself of it the very first opportunity." And that was from Bess Truman in a letter on December 31st. And the other letter that I'll read is an excerpt from a letter that reveals that while Harry enjoyed sharing details of his life with Bess, he primarily wrote to her in hopes of a response, which he would treasure a great deal. And this letter is April 8th, 1912. "I really don't care what you do with my letter, so as long as you write me. That's what I'm laboring for, a letter from you. You may read them to anyone you choose, put them in your parlor carpet, or start fires with them, just as long as you send me an answer, which, by the way, won't be used for any of the above-mentioned purposes." So I kind of love that because a heart-to-heart message and a love in 1911 still resonates with people today, I am sure. So that heart-to-heart message is an Valentine's Day and President's Day.
So do you think in the future people will be reading Instagram messages?
Yes, they'll be so short. Or tweets. So 120 characters of saying how much they love each other or how mad they are that they're not getting a response. Why would you tweet me? It'll be a different love.
Or looking at Snapchat's images that are, you know, between people that The way my teenage nieces now do it with the people that they love.
There's something lost about that. I do love reading through those letters. It's very sweet.
Yeah, it's very nice.
Yeah, so the next heart-to-heart messages, which, by the way, I've been getting so many heart-to-heart messages, I'm having a hard time catching up. So if you send me a heart-to-heart message, don't worry, I will get to it one way or the other. But this one is from a favorite person at KHOI. Which is, who is DJ Stephanie Bates. So she sent me this one. It reads as follows. "Hi, Anna Banana. Here's an email I sent to my former boss of 8 years at Mary Greeley. He is the CEO, Brian Dieter. This is my heart-to-heart I wanted to share with you. Mostly it's very scary going to the hospital, very sick with a virus that is killing people. Thank goodness I had angels taking good care of me. I'm also grateful to my son for the time we were stuck in the basement for 12 days, for being awesome and for having a chance to bond with each other a bit more, even in sickness." And here's her heart-to-heart message to Brian Dieter. "Hello there, Brian. I haven't talked to you in forever. Hope all is well with you. The hospital has been amazing throughout this COVID pandemic. I ended up with it, and the staff was awesome. Both Landon and I had it, and we ended up in now is called COVID Cave in our basement for 2 weeks. But because I couldn't breathe near the end of it, I went to the emergency department. Landon's symptoms were not as serious, but he was still very sick and slept most of the time. It was the same for me. Many people brought us food, and the radio station bought me a microwave and toaster for the basement so we could actually heat up our food. I digress. Back to the service. The best part of the staff in the emergency department was their calming nature, even given that they're handling 10 things at once. I honestly was concerned with my breathing and my heart, and they calmed my fears and took great care of me, made me feel like I was safe and in good hands. The safe part is so crucial. Being in good hands and feeling like you will be okay is so important. This is what the staff showed me that day. I also felt they did a good job keeping me social distance when I was waiting for a room, and they got me in right away. Within 4 minutes, I was hooked up to a bunch of things and heart monitors and all sorts of stuff. Again, probably 4 minutes total. You don't always think about it until you are the one in the emergency department. I am so grateful for each and every person that helped me that day. I just wanted to take a moment to tell you how grateful I am for Mary Greeley and each of the staff members that helped me. My best and thanks for putting up with me for all those years. I get to work now at 7:50 a.m. every morning. You would be impressed. Getting older and actually more responsible. Who would have thought? Hope your winter is going well and that no one unravels your winter stocking cap by cutting it apart. Stephanie. Then she also sends this. Also a big shout out at the same point to the amazing staff at Iowa State and the Chemistry and Physics Astronomy Department for their insanely awesome kindness and knowledge as I learned my new job. The university environment is something everyone should be so lucky to be part of. They say that a new job is one of the most stressful things that can happen in life's right, and it's true. But at Iowa State, I feel like I have a family. So then she ends her heart-to-heart message with, I hope you relax a bit on the weekend. Sounds like you need it. Stay warm for real. Keep a blanket in your car and gloves and a hat if you don't. I needed those things once in winter with a car problem, and I didn't have them and learned my lesson. Also, a granola bar in your car. So if you get stuck somewhere with no food, you can ration one chocolate chip, one piece of oat, etc. LOL. And definitely a flashlight and first aid kit. Do you have any of these things? Now I have a good kit for winter. And that is DJ Stephanie's heart-to-heart messages, making sure that we stay warm if we're stuck in a car. Thank you.
Very, very wise words. Very wise words. Thank you, Anna, and thank you, Stephanie. And you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, here with Anna Banana and Mike Murphy at the control panels. Thank you for listening to us. Also, remember, you can hear a recording of this show later on at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Remember to check in tonight at 7 p.m. when KHOI is pleased to continue to introduce a new program called Capital Week, which will feature Laura Bellin, author of the blog Bleeding Heartland, and will be hosted by KHOI newsman Dennis Hart, covering all things politics and governance here in Iowa. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m., and remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. And Anna?
We'll see you again on the radio.
That's right.